objective ought to be to make the pie larger. It ought not to be just simply absorb those people who aren't getting a piece of the pie and trying to spread them around among the other people.
Precisely. And if the pie is made larger, the demand for goods and services is greater and more is being produced, I would rely upon a free enterprise America system, American business, to spend money, to expand, to do what is necessary, where it appears necessary. It's to build a new plant, to build a new plant.
But Professor Eisner, it isn't just the demand that enlarges the pie. You have to have the resources and the production to enlarge that pie. And sometimes those don't necessarily produce more jobs. They produce more goods and sometimes more services.
Well, that may be. You know, for example, Dr. Burns referred to the matter of making us competitive in foreign markets. I would say we all know that the industry in which we're most competitive, so to speak, is agriculture. We have a tremendous advantage. We could export great amounts of agricultural products. Now, when you offer tax incentives to American business, what you're saying is we're going to tilt the system, not necessarily just in favor of investment. In fact, what you'll be doing is tilting the system to those capital-intensive industries that use a lot of equipment. And that means you would tend to make us less competitive in the areas that are not getting that kind of tax advantage.
But agriculture is a capital-intensive industry.
Certainly
per worker it is.
We'd have to check as to whether the extent of equipment tax credit benefits to agriculture as compared to the steel industry or most of the automobile industry, places that are tremendously intensive.
There's no tax credit on land.
I'm talking about those big pieces of equipment that are used.
There are some. I think you see that, unfortunately, I believe is one of the myths. You have something like a tax credit, which overwhelmingly helps heavily capital-intensive, concentrated industry. But every little farmer, every small businessman will lobby congressmen and say, well, we can't take that away. I remember being before the, I believe it was the House Budget Committee, Mr. Connable indicated, you know, you can talk as an economist, you can tell us to get rid of the corporate income tax instead of having an equipment tax credit, but you don't face a political problem. Why don't we face up to that? All economists will say, if taxes are too high, lower taxes. Don't look for new exemptions, new incentives, but instead, I guess eliminating the corporate tax would look very unprofitable.
I don't know if you have no quarrel with me. I would prefer a reduction of the corporate income tax to an increase in the investment.
I knew you did, Dr. Burns. I've read some of your earlier.
I would share that position too, but I don't think you ought to suggest that the capital incentives are not productive of jobs, because I think they are.
There are many things productive of jobs, though, from public employment to private employment to job training programs to educating people so they can work. In fact, this strikes me as the most indirect, far-fetched way of encouraging jobs. If you want to cut a tax that will directly affect jobs, I would cut payroll taxes. I would do the exact opposite of what President Ford proposed, of raising our payroll tax for Social Security from 11.7% to 12.3%. If you're worried about unemployment among youth, it's utterly absurd and folly to add to the fact that young people are difficult to employ, have high unemployment, to give the employer additional cost of paying for Social Security benefits. He's not going to realize for 40 or 50 years.
What about the minimum wage?
The minimum wage, there are lots of political problems with the minimum wage, and I would say that if you can't...
What about the economic problems?
I would meet the problem of the minimum wage, essentially, by guaranteeing through effective action that everybody in our productive society is able to produce enough to make it profitable for an employer to hire them. And if there are people who are untrained and not in the job market, young people, and that's where the shoe really pinches, who you feel will not be worth it to an employer, there's a good place then for the government to intervene if necessary, to have subsidies, to see to it that it becomes profitable to hire young people. That is an investment in capital which you cannot expect the free enterprise system to make, because no employer can train a young worker, take the chances of turning out good, and figure, gee, what is the gain? If the guy does turn out well, then he can't own it, and he can only be
The timing of that, though, it seems to me, is when the recovery begins. You had that kind of a system at the end of World War II, when you had a GI Bill program that subsidized industry to hire people and train them, and then reduce the amount of subsidy that they got as they worked toward journeyman level. But that has to be done at a time when you've got the recovery underway.
No,
that may be appropriate
be
at this time, but if they're not going to do it anyway, they're not going to be stimulated to make an investment.
You've got young people coming to the market every year, Congressman, and it seems to me that paying for the on-the-job training out of federal funds becomes the finesse that he's talking about to achieve the same purpose without taking on the political battle trying to fight minimum wage. In other words, you guarantee the minimum wage, but you're going to spend the public dollar anyway, paying for the guy's education, whether it's in a vocational school, occupational college, or a junior college, or a university. So why not pay it on the job to the employer, but require there to be some real on-the-job training so the person can make that progress up the career ladder.
It becomes a subsidy, but it
avoids the political question that he was raising with you, that if you directly attack the minimum wage, you're going to lose. If you say you're going to provide on-the-job training, you can win. The purpose is served. Why fight about the method?
If it's a chicken, you call it a swan, it becomes a swan, right?
Brilliant.
I think it'd be well for all of us that talk about subsidies for training. As I said yesterday, there's no one with a college education can deny that he's had the biggest subsidy of any citizen of the United States. Yeah. Let's knock it off. I mean, everybody that's gone to college has been subsidized, and plenty. So a little subsidization to people that are trying to learn how to get a job and something beyond higher education is not, I think, is not beyond our means. I don't like this elitism argument that we've all got to have a college education in order to be worthy of American citizenship. Some people may just want to learn how to weld. They might want to learn how to repair a TV. They might even want to learn how to put on a roof. It might be helpful. And it doesn't help you get a PhD to do that. I'm not against PhDs or MAs. I just don't think they're necessarily required for everybody. I'd like to just quickly join in so we get some fact in here. Then I want Dr. Greenspan to get in it. I asked our staff person here to give me a little idea on the percentage of federal tax revenues coming from corporate income tax, because there was word about confiscatory taxation. In the 1950s, 33% of all tax revenue came from the corporations. Today, it's 14%. The real going tax rate on corporations is about 38%, and the banks, it's 11%. Now, if you've got an income of around $40,000 a year, you'd have to give you about $40,000 a year personal income, you pay 38% tax. So the corporate, I want to say that I think a lot of tax changes are needed, and I tend to agree with what's said here, that if you want to make adjustments, do it on the corporate tax rate. I believe in capital formation. And I think it's essential that we put our minds to it. But I don't think we ought to scare people. I don't think we ought to say that corporate taxation is confiscatory, because it is not. And if it were, how come all these private planes? It isn't confiscatory. I don't think we ought to say that it's gone up, because it's gone down.
It's a double dip.
Well, double dip or not, there's still plenty to dip.
Senator, at the same time that the corporate tax is going down, the Social Security portion of federal revenues, which is the most regressively based portion, was going up dramatically.
The fact is, in the 1950s, the average corporate share of the federal tax revenue was 33% from corporate income. Today, it's 14%. Now, that doesn't mean that it couldn't be improved. I'm not arguing that point. I'd like to just say one other quick thing about inflation control. Two biggest items on inflation were centered here today, energy and food, or raw materials and food. And this is something over which a president didn't have any control, or Dr. Burns, or Congress. But from the point of view of our inflation rate, we were in the best position on both, because we had a larger share of domestic production in both than any other industrialized country in the world. We had the largest share. We had food in abundance. Therefore, we did not suffer the same inflationary pressures from food prices that other people did, recognizing that it might be even, I recognize the world market, but our prices domestically for food have been less than other prices in other parts of the world. Secondly, on fuel, we produced approximately 65% or better of our own fuel, domestic fuel resources. We imported about 35%. That's up a little bit now. But again, we had lower fuel costs than any other industrialized nation in the world. And those are two terrific items in the budget. So the two items that have been the biggest factors in inflation rates worldwide were food and energy. And in both of those items, we were in a very favorable position. That doesn't mean we didn't suffer from them, and I think the point's made.
I can't follow you, Lee.
You can't?
No, because prices we pay for fuel are at the international level.
Not at all. We had a fixed price on our 65% of our domestic oil production, Doctor. We were paying an average of $7 a barrel for oil here, while the rest of the world was paying an average of $11. because we did not let the oil companies raise their prices on domestic fuel. And even today, we're paying an average of 9 as compared to 13. So we did get a benefit on fuel. I mean, rightly or wrongly, and the oil companies didn't like it. I'm not arguing whether we did the right thing or not. I think we did, but we paid less for it. And on food, we obviously paid less because we did not have to pay the international cost of shipping and of handling and storage, which goes into the international market.
However, I ought to point out, Senator, that the price that we're paying for energy is going up rapidly because of that price freeze. I think it now exceeds 45%, and that price freeze means that we're going to pay more and more for that $13 barrel oil.
Well, in the meantime,
we have improved
fuel efficiency, industrial efficiency. The cost to American industry today on fuel for the same amounts is appreciably less because we have improved our fuel efficiency. We have companies that have gone into other companies, like DuPont has a segment of their company that teaches fuel conservation, so that while the fuel costs have gone up, we've also gotten better use out of our fuel. We know that. Dr. Greenspan, you want to get in this business, you've been over there. We don't want to let your fertile mind here and active mind go unused. I want you to get in there and take them on now for a while. Congressman Brown, I'll shut up. Go ahead.
After that introduction, I'm speechless.
Don't get speechless around here.
No, I've enjoyed just sitting here for a change and listening. It's not usually been the luxury to do so. I'd like to raise a couple of issues which I think directly relate to the basic discussion this morning. They're somewhat unrelated, but I think not necessarily. First is the relationship between inflation and unemployment. And I think rather than look at the historical record and try to discuss the various different statistics we're looking at and various complex macroeconomic equations we tend to construct, I think I'd just like to point out something about the current period, the most immediate period, which I think is very well worth observing. It's fairly obvious to anyone who was looking at the particular set of numbers that we've observed in the last several weeks that there is a very perceptible improvement in confidence in our economy. That is, you can see it in the consumer area, you can begin to see it stirring in the business investment area. And where I think it's very perceptibly coming from is the decline in the instability, the decline in the inflationary patterns that have existed in this economy for a number of years. And I think that the decline in the consumer price index, which I think you may be aware, Mr. Chairman, was 0.1 in the release that came out this morning, which we considered to be obviously quite favorable. I think what we're seeing is that as this instability simmers down, the extraordinary reluctance on the part of our households to buy goods, to be aggressive in the consumer markets, is changing. I mean, we have seen not only the indexes of consumer confidence rising, but we're now beginning to see finally the savings rates falling, most immediately manifested in the extraordinary pickup in passenger car sales during the month of February and in March. And this to me is suggesting that the uncertainties, the risk premiums, the concerns of our households in purchasing are a function of the degree of inflation. Also, we're beginning to see similar stirrings going on in the business investment area, where the high degree of uncertainty and risk induced probably, although the evidence here is difficult to come by, a marked increase in risk premiums in investment activities. That is, we're getting a much higher rate of return required in the last several years to initiate investment than have existed in previous years. I think with the simmering down of inflation, with the simmering down of instability and uncertainty, I think that is beginning to change as well. And hence the recovery that we're looking at right now to a very substantial extent
rests upon the reduction of inflation itself. Now, the interrelationship that we get between inflation and unemployment and growth is a very complex one, and I would scarcely say, as Professor Eisner indicated, that I would say that fast growth implies inflation. I don't believe that at all. I think it's quite possible to get very significant growth without inflation, but also vice versa. I think it's quite possible to get stagnant growth in inflation environments. I don't think these are closely tied in the way that we can conventionally see them. So that what I am indicating, and as far as I think a terribly important but very rarely discussed policy issue at this point, is to further reduce the degree of uncertainty about the future and the general concern. And I think we will continue to see the type of recovery that we have observed in the last 2 or 3 months, which I've indicated previously. I think is obviously well in excess of our forecasts, and I think most anybody else's forecasts I can see. And I might also say that this particular phenomenon of inflation, uncertainty, risk, and investment is manifesting itself in the written of other major industrial countries in the world. And so that this is not a simple problem which is US-oriented at all. And I think that we have to focus on a recognition that if we allow inflationary instabilities to reemerge in this particular period, we are going to very likely get the same sort of economic malaise that has hit us through the period prior to throughout the mid-1970s. Now, Mr. Chairman, on a second and somewhat unrelated point, but I think something we ought to be thinking about, really gets at the nature of looking at this whole question of what we mean by unemployment, and a recognition that there are so many different types of unemployment which require different focuses and different remedies. And the one thing which I think we rarely tend to realize, and except technicians, is that when we talk about excessively high rates of unemployment, which there's no question they are at the moment, and there is no question that there are vast numbers of people who are in extremely dire straits. I think that one doesn't have to look at the numbers to observe that phenomenon. But what it is not 7 million people who are going to be unemployed for 1 year or 2 years. We have a different type of problem. If in fact the 7 million unemployed were the same people, I would say the types of remedies we are talking about would have to be completely different. What we are observing is the usual extraordinarily rapid turnover that exists in our labor markets, and that we have, say 30 million spells of unemployment a year, and that far greater number of people experience unemployment once or twice and sometimes three times a year than the average involved. And what this means is that the vast amount of unemployment is 2, 3, and 4 weeks, and that the average is sometimes 6, and in a period like now, I suspect, although we don't have the data, it's probably closer to 10. Now the reason I raise this as an issue is that it is very important that the types of policies which we apply to this problem confront the nature of the problem and not something else. And here, one of the reasons I'm concerned about, one, the nature of some of the broader programs of public service employment, and I'd like to collaterally say a few things good about unemployment insurance, although a number of people, I think, have said things with which I agree. Because of the fact that the vast proportion of unemployment at any particular time is represented by people who will be back having jobs within periods of reasonably a small number of weeks, it's a mistake to draw them out and put them at jobs or give them types of jobs which could deflect them from searching for the jobs with a future, the jobs which are high-paying, the jobs which are productive. And I think we must be very careful, in, no matter how we come out on some of these policies, to make certain that what we're doing is confronting the real problem. And here, one of the reasons why I think it's important to recognize that unemployment insurance does serve a great, and I think more than a cushioning sort of problem, is that it's very difficult to fashion a program which cushions the unemployment problem when the period is indeterminate. And in that sense, what unemployment insurance does is it adjusts itself automatically whether a person is unemployed for 4 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, or 16 weeks. When he goes back and gets a job, that's over. And I think that one of the difficulties that we have with a number of these other types of programs is you lock in people in types of jobs which I think in very many instances makes their future employment opportunities a lot less than they would otherwise be. And I would merely suggest that when we think in terms of unemployment, I think I've gotten to say this, it certainly does affect the vast number of people, but in a way not only be it not in one sense, because there are so many more people unemployed at some point. But I think that we have a tendency, and I think unfortunately some of our policy discussions too often seem to assume, even indirectly, even perhaps even unconsciously, that when we talk about the high levels of unemployment, it's the same people all the time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Congressman Hector, I know that you have questions.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank you for structuring this really meaningful conference and for your continued leadership and your in-depth investigation of the problems of unemployment, which brought you even to the important, in my sense, but perhaps in a national sense, rather obscure site of Fall River, Massachusetts, in search of a meaningful understanding of the problems of unemployment. I think this conference today, yesterday and today, these have been very, very important sessions, and they have been very, very stimulating. I am so envious of all of my colleagues who have this sense of certainty about the answers, and the panelists as well. But I have to confess that my own mood is a nagging skepticism. I am the unpersuaded juror, as impressed as I am with the rhetoric by which all of you have articulated, and indeed as certain as I am that I will extract the best proposals each has offered, perhaps offering them again later as my own. But the fact is that despite all of this, I think I have become too disillusioned over the failures of programs with which arouse great expectations, the failures of the Great Society to really resolve the problems of poverty, the failure of the Economic Opportunity Act to really provide economic opportunity for everyone. All of these failures are too real in my mind, and my own sense of hope when I voted for many of these programs has turned to a, I think, almost a sense of disillusionment. Now I'm deeply troubled about unemployment. I have a district in which there's 12% unemployment, and I see this as a moral problem for the country, one which we must address. But we must not address it in such a way as to create new expectations and, again, the inevitable disillusionment and bitterness. And that's what I would hope to avoid. I have recently visited the People's Republic of where I saw the work ethic in such a full-blown representation that I was envious again. And I asked many of the Chinese why they were working so hard in this society. And they discussed the preconditions to their revolution and to the world in which they find themselves. They earlier felt they were the property of the society or the landowners or the vested interests, and now they felt a share in the nation building, and they were willing to work for it. And that seems to me to underscore the significance of the profit-sharing proposal, which one of the panelists has mentioned today, Senator Chavez. I think this is very important, that people share in the profits. I am deeply concerned about the fact that that when we discuss unemployment, there isn't enough emphasis or sensitivity to the unemployment among women. And I'm very delighted that Mr. Harrington raised that issue, because I think that's a very real problem in society. And I hope that Mr. Greenspan will include in the next report of the Council of Economic Advisors an analysis of the impact on women, which is missing in this year's report. Nonetheless, I still am left with many questions, and the questions do not go to the goals of the legislation, because I think they're desirable, in fact, imperative. But my questions are really relevant to the situation in which we find ourselves today, to what are the politically viable alternatives which will give real meaning to this legislation. And I look at the, listen to the proposal for the reduction of corporate taxes, and that's not politically viable. And on the other hand, we heard Dr. Burns talk about reduction in the minimum wage for certain categories of workers, and that's not politically viable. So what we're really looking at, in my judgment, at this point, in the abstract, since we cannot affect all the other related issues in one piece of legislation for jurisdictional reasons and others, looking at this proposal today, as it stands, and adding it to all of the other legislation and the costs of other legislation on the books, what are we doing to the question of inflation, and what are really what are we doing to the economy today if we were to pass one more piece of legislation without having the opportunity to change those other legislative issues that the panelists have individually commented upon? Now, Mr. Eisner, I wonder, what is your response? If we cannot change the corporate tax structure, and if Dr. Burns, if his proposal on the minimum wage and your proposal on subsidies for training youth are not politically viable, and I really do not feel that they are, then what would you say, what would the impact of the Humphrey-Hawkins bill be on inflation?
First, I should quickly say that as far as the corporate income tax goes, I do not mean to suggest eliminating it really as a method of tax reduction. The proposal generally is simply that individual taxpayers, they include corporate income, they share it in their own taxable income. And of course, it's a very unpleasant question to raise, and understandable if what we think makes best sense economically cannot be done, what else should we do? However, cursory reading, but on not studied reading of the Humphrey-Hawkins bill, I do find it a generally quite attractive proposal. And I don't see that it should contribute to inflation in any way. The problems, you run into many problems with something like this as to how to avoid unintended effects. I believe that Mr. Harrington raised one, which I think you picked up, was very important. I also brought the reading. You know, you have a proposal that public employment be available particularly on the basis of income in the family or any other, how many wage earners are in the family. And that's just a disastrous interference with individual freedom and particularly a discouragement of women working and of young people. So I guess the important thing would be to take that proposal, and I'm sure in the legislative process it will be carefully scrutinized to get all kinds of expert testimony, and push ahead with it.
Do you feel that there would be any impact on inflation?
I don't see how it would be an impact on inflation. That is, to the extent you are having people produce more, it may, if they're not producing things that go to the market or are competitive with market production, then it's true you will be increasing demand, but that will enable people to buy more. And with all due respect, again, to Mr. Greenspan's remarks a few moments ago, suggesting that there's a lot of salvation to be found in the attitudes of people and their psychologies, and if they are not too worried, the economy will advance. And not being a psychologist, I've always been a little bit skeptical of this kind of an explanation. I would say that the economy advances when somebody is spending more to buy our goods and services, in the government, business, or private home business purchases. Now, you can't have it two ways. If you want greater purchasing power to produce more, then you'll have to have that. And to say that may be inflationary, I think is indicating a lack of real commitment to full employment and prosperity. And I think that indeed has been the critical problem now for 30 years. Every time there's a serious effort to try to promote full employment, except in time of war, people hold back saying that that may be inflationary. Now, there are can be inflationary problems when we get unemployment in some sense too low, but it's hardly ever been that. In fact, I would argue that in our kind of economy, you can never worry about that except in times of war, so I hope we won't have to worry about it particularly. And I would say that the Humphrey-Hawkins bill has nothing to do with inflation. If it does anything by promoting more people, by somehow encouraging training, increasing the supply of labor, it would tend to make more product available at lower costs and reduce inflation. So I wouldn't think of it as having much to do primarily with inflation at all.
Do you look upon the goal of public employment as desirable in itself or as a temporary solution to a temporary answer to the problem of the jobless person who ultimately should find a place in the private sector? And if that's the case and you feel the private sector is going to provide the long-term and best compensating job opportunities, then should the public employment have an incentive and there be a slightly less attractive than the jobs in the private sector, thereby allowing the incentive of the private market to lure that person back into private employment?
I would not take the position I understand Dr. Burns to take of making the public employment entirely unattractive. I think one should be concerned.
I don't think Dr. Burns said it should be entirely unattractive.
Well,
it should be less attractive. Substantially.
Yeah, but very substantially. I think it might be a mistake in terms of allocation of resources for the government to pay, let us say, a full private industry wage to people who are not able to produce that much on a long-term basis, because that would tend to promote uneconomic operations. I would say, however, that there is a lot of government activity which would be highly productive, where people could be hired to do things in which they'd be fully capable of producing an income equivalent to theirs in private industry, and I would not discourage that. That is to say, you know, that we don't really value help in our educational process or in cleaning our land or in our police forces or anything else. I might add, just in connection with Mr. Greenspan's remarks on unemployment insurance, that I can see some problem, which I'm sure Mr. Greenspan is aware of, they're all economists, and that is that there are, without saying that that's a major source of our unemployment, no doubt many people with unemployment benefits figure, well, I don't have to work that hard for a job, or I can afford to quit this job and I'll get some benefits. Well, I'm a little bit puzzled to why in that context he would not want to encourage the availability, perhaps insist upon public employment rather than unemployment benefits. Because I would think that if a person were told, well, you have unemployment benefits for 4 or 8 weeks, but then you've got to go to work in some government job or else you lose it, you might get some of these people to opt for looking a little bit harder for private employment.
Can I ask a question? I just read the headlines in the Times here. It says Italy announces austerity steps to ease inflation. We've got at least 3 major Western governments in the world, the British, the Italians, and the Argentinians, that are apparently about to collapse because of inflation rates, primarily. Now, isn't that a danger? Is there, or is there no stability danger in inflation?
Well, I may come perilously close to suggesting that inflation is not the problem. I can imagine catastrophic inflation as we should demolish the economy, but that is really not the problem. You know, we have spectacles of very prosperous economies with a lot of inflation. We have, you know, my good colleague Milton Friedman, south of me in Chicago, was fond of saying, you know, you can show high growth and
to the right
low growth. I think Mr. Greenspan has just indicated you can have unemployment sometimes with inflation and sometimes out of it, expansion with it or without it. And the problems of the Italian economy, for even those of us who view it from afar, are pretty deep. You know, that there's a very ineffective governmental system with huge amounts of graft and corruption. I don't know.
Large
that could be. I mean, you have wasteful public employment that can do it. But it's not the inflation per se. I mean, if their economy were growing if output were increasing, if they were close to full
employment. Through government employment now?
Through either means, whatever the means. I mean, if the real output is growing, plus if the government is simply hiring more people and having them sit on their salaries, when people don't have the goods that they need, then that's the real problem.
All right, John Russell, do you want to comment?
Well, I think the time has really passed for too much more comment. I have enjoyed the chance to be here and sit for 2 hours and listen. It's a new experience for me. I guess that's good discipline. I really would have liked a chance to... I don't want to take the time of other people. Everybody keeps moving on to lunch or wherever they're going, and I don't want to be the one to hold everybody up. I was hoping we could discuss more extensively. In Banking and Currency Committee, we have talked many times about the impact of unemployment insurance and its length, not the fact that we don't need it. As Dr. Burns has said many times when he was in the academic community during the 30s, they generated the idea of unemployment insurance to cushion the ability of the lower income people to be able to adjust to other jobs and give them a chance to adjust, whereas the wealthy didn't need the adjustment because they usually had savings and other things to cushion their adjustment when they were confronted with unemployment. But the question that I have is unemployment insurance at 65 weeks has become highly expensive and, I mean, for the length of time. And is there a question whether, as Reisner said, does the person tend to wait till the last, not all of them do, obviously, but do they tend to wait till the last 4 or 5 weeks before they seriously look for a job? Well, in all cases, they, of course, do not. But I would like to put it in the record, Senator, a letter from Arthur Burns, where I had, which was a response to questions that I had raised on this issue, and he's of unemployment insurance and it is the extent of time. And I'm sorry if I could,
yes.
Where he discusses several Brookings economic reports and another one that was done on the effect of unemployment insurance in Pennsylvania, a very detailed study. And I'm sorry we didn't get more time to get into the minimum wage because I really think that does have a substantial derogatory impact on youth and in some cases women. I see my panelist, Mr. Harrington, shaking his head, and I'm sorry I really haven't had a chance to talk to him about the benefits of socialism, because I'd really like to hear more about all the benefits of socialism in England. That's the glaring.
How would you like to hear about the TV?
Can I say just one word, Senator, because this, I'm afraid we're going to suffer from the English example for the next 10 years. I'd like to point out.
I hope we don't.
I wish the Congress might look at the Swedish example where unemployment is under 2%. Secondly, considering
if I could respond to that, they also give tremendous tax credits to their business to encourage them to create new jobs and new equipment, and they give tremendous incentives to their private sector to produce jobs. They don't rely just on government.
No, of course. But all I'm saying is that the British thing is going to be driven to death. Only one last point on Britain.
Oh, it's not driven to death. We just don't want to go down the
All right. Well, one last point on Britain. I would just point out to you that the Heath government spent 3.5 years of giving massive governmental subsidies to private business and had enormous public borrowing for that purpose. And what bothers me is that we're in danger in this society of coming to a very facile generalization. Because in a society with a welfare state of some substance, a crisis has occurred, we will say, because it has a welfare state, it's on account of the welfare state. In reality, I think the English situation is much more complex and involves English capitalism as well as English socialism, if you will, and involves the Conservative Party as well as the Labour Party.
But there was a
clear, we have to be very careful.
There was a clear admission also that the nationalization of the major industries has been a massive failure.
I'm afraid that they did what we're doing with the railroads. They nationalized all the industries that were totally messed up by British capitalism. I wish that on an occasion, somewhere in this world, we would nationalize a going concern.
Hope that we keep the conversation somewhat within the purviews of the American scene. We are celebrating our bicentennial. I no longer thought we were a colony, but go ahead.
I just want to add comment on unemployment compensations. I don't think most persons who've been unemployed long relish being unemployed. There's a psychologically debilitating effect there, and I think most of us recognize that continuing unemployment is something they would cheerfully give up for any kind of a good job. I think the notion that after 13 weeks they might be referred to a public employment for a chance to keep their skills up would be a very major step forward. I join in imploring the 65 weeks. If we're going to spend that kind of money, why not have a person working and get the community getting the benefit of that? So I wouldn't want my silence to be an expression of agreement. I also want to add one footnote to Congressman Heckler's comment. I think a council of either cynicism or despair by appointed or elected officials is devastating to the public. I think if those of us who hold public office are not willing to keep the faith, as Adam is to say, the public really is being served very badly by us. And if we feel that cynical or that despairing, we really ought to resign.
Well, now, gentlemen, we've come to a point where we're going to let our panelists retire and enjoy, hopefully, a luncheon. Let me just add to the record that I have a letter here from Mr. Leonard Woodcock in reference to the endorsement of the UAW's convention on the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act of 1976, known as the Humphrey-Hawkins Bill. I'll ask it to be included in the record. I should also like to note for on the matters that we've been talking, just to fill in the record here a little, that there are 1.5 million workers who have been unemployed or out of work for over 6 months. I say this because I think Dr. Greenspan made a point that there are different types of unemployment, and we need to, as we look at any legislative proposal, be cognizant of the different types of unemployment. But here is 1.5 million of them, and by the way, that 1.5 million will be without benefits very shortly, because the funds are all used up, which poses another problem that no one has really directed their attention to. I also note that the 1975 national average weekly unemployment insurance benefit paid by the states was $70. That's gross, $70 a week. In this day and age, that is not exactly what you would call living it up. There are a number of states which paid unemployment compensation benefits less than the national average. Mississippi paid $48 a week, Texas $54 a week, New Mexico $55 a week, Oklahoma $56 a week, Tennessee $57 a week. And I also would include in this point a reference to the rates of unemployment that have existed in other countries over a 10-year average from 1962 to 1973. That's before the high unemployment rates and when we were having relatively good employment as well. Japan, 1.3. France, 1.8. Germany, 1.3. United Kingdom, with all of its problems, 2.4. And that during that same period of time, our unemployment rate was over 5% on the average. So, we still have problems of unemployment that we cannot afford to ignore or to pretend that they're non-existent. I wish that Dr. Burns hadn't have left because he made such a humorous comment about the White House and monetary policy. I can only think of one thing worse than having it made in the White House, and that is a group of people making it who have a special interest in high interest rates. I consider that a conflict of interest. I think that political leaders that would make a monetary policy trying to be specialists would be a disaster. But I do think that political people have the responsibility to set goals and to set targets. That's what the political process is for. And then we rely upon the so-called experts and the technicians to try to help us accomplish those goals. Confer comes out through the Federal Reserve banking system of his region. But the Federal Reserve Board, I think, needs to have, if we can't find a way to do it by voluntary selection, then I think we ought to mandate it. I just think people that use credit ought to have something to say about its supply, that's all. And I don't think that means a congressman ought to tell you what the credit ought to be, but I do think that the central bank ought to have better representation. It's been my prejudice and just my point of view, and I don't want Congress to run the system. I would finally add that the purpose of the Humphrey-Hawkins bill is not to see that within 1 year, there's no projection of putting people on massive government payrolls. emphasis has been stated here, even as a point of criticism, was to rev up, to stimulate the private economy. And how? By trying to have this president, in cooperation with the Council of Economic Advisors, to preserve the work would be required to issue a report either concurring to these markets or explaining why the Fed would not conduct the monetary policy necessary for achieving it. To get some accountability, impossible to say that at the end of 1976 unemployment should be not more than 6%. That's a goal. Or the gross national product should have a real increase of 8%. That's a reasonable goal. And if you did that, and that inflation rate should not exceed 4%, that's a goal. Then you direct the policies to the Congress of the United States and the Congress. And if those targets are ascertainable in the judgment of the elected officials, then policies must be effectuated to accomplish them. And what? Not that the government does it. But if it requires, for example, a change in the tax system, better investment, or more training, as was said, and I think the point's been well made here, that capital accumulation is not merely in money, but in skills. If those are the goals, or if those activities are necessary, then we ought to go at them. I believe, I want to say very frankly, that I never feel that any piece of legislation that's introduced is the ultimate. It is a projection. It is an expression of hope. It is a point around which you focus attention. But we need to decide just one question, because it's here. Are we going to permit a rate of unemployment to exist for the next 3 or 4 years that no one in the government has estimated will be less than 5% by 1980? And are we going to permit more and more people to lose their unemployment compensation benefits, to be on welfare, to be on the dole, or are we going to provide some other alternative? That's all it boils down to. I don't think there's any other choice. There isn't. You just can't have a maybe attitude here. You've got to make up your mind to try to do in our system, might I say, in this capitalistic or mixed system. It isn't just capitalism, it's a mixed system. Are we going to put the emphasis there in every way we know to get employment expanded and unemployment absorbed? And let's assume that miracles are performed. Let's presume that we have a 10% real growth in GNP, which would mean that by the end of this year, calendar year 76, we could have 6% unemployment. That's about the best we could get. Wouldn't that be right, Dr. Greenspan? About 6%. That leaves you 5.5 to 6 million people unemployed. Let's say that of that 5.5 to 6 million, only 2 million are really long-term unemployment. I think you make a well-established point. There's a lot of transitional unemployment, mobility. There's the constant movement in our labor force. But let's say there are 2 million. What are you going to do with them? What kind of waste are we willing to tolerate? Now, I think then the question becomes simply this, and these are real alternatives. Either you have an income maintenance program for them, because you can't let them starve, or you have an income maintenance program for them of what? Well, at least you'd have to get it up to the poverty levels. Or you have an employment program for them. There isn't anything else. You can't put them to sleep. That's it. And so I think that what we're really talking about here is structural reformation of economic policy-making machinery, on the one hand, structural analysis of the unemployment problem in the country, the employment, the labor force, and then facing up to the gap, the lag, between the incomes, how do you handle the human equation. Because economics loses its meaning as a science when it gets down to the point where it says, well, we can forget 2 million, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million people. And I repeat what I said in the beginning, that no public policy can be justified for price stability. That requires, as the price of stability, ever-increasing destruction on the part of a substantial number of fellow citizens. You can't do that. That's exactly like saying that the way you get law and order is that if there are too many people on the streets, you shoot them. You can't do that. It is a terrible thing that's happened to us in this country that we
gotten down to the point where we're arguing about details.
I have the impression that we both have the committee and the stock exchange have the same goals, and now it looks to me as though we have finally agreed on the proper way of resolving this great economic dilemma. It's a matter of mechanics from here on.
My concern is basically this. I think prominent leaders in business and government are frightening the living daylights out of people.
I'm not saying
no, but I want to say, when they come in here and talk about crowding out, that the Social Security program is bankrupt, and that the country is spending itself into bankruptcy, and this is what we hear from prominent people in this country. I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything, but I hear it continuously, and it scares the living daylights out of people. Everything is relative. Here, for example, on the matter of the public debt, the debt has dropped just sharply in terms of percentage of GNP. And that's really what's relative. You know, I mean, let's face it, a man, a businessman that's got an income of $1 million a year in gross receipts and has a debt of $250,000 is a whole lot better off than a businessman that has an income of $250,000 and has a debt of $25,000. A whole lot better. The debt is related to the debt must be related to the production, to the GNP. And I think that what we've had happen here is they're trying to be overly simplistic to appeal to what they think is the essential rural attitudes of America, the old-fashioned attitudes. My people in rural America, which by the way is bigger business than the stock market, it's real big business. The biggest business in America today is agriculture. And they are big borrowers, and they are big investors. People out in my part of the country have their, many of them have $500,000 invested in their little business they call independent business. Those people understand the difference. They're not stupid. They know that they've got to borrow larger sums of money today in order to have a bigger production. They know that, and they're willing to make the risk. And I'm simply saying that it doesn't help our country to have prominent people, not you, sir, but many prominent people fighting the living daylights out of folks. I got a lot of confidence in this country.
Well, in conclusion, then, let me say for the record that I personally have the greatest conviction that this is the greatest country in the world, and that the economy of this country is the strongest economy in this world. I also believe that we have the greatest social and political system. And I believe that these aberrations that we run into every 4 or 5 years are simply as I described. And that this country will move forward, will retain its supremacy in economic and political areas, and the American people will have the opportunity to move upward, change their status in life in the future to the same extent that their predecessors. And that there is no reason that I'm aware of why any American should have any hesitancy about having confidence in this country.
I agree with that. I'm bullish on the country. I'm a little pessimistic about some of its spokesmen, but I'm very bullish on the country. I just don't believe that we got leaders that can louse it up enough to stop us from going ahead. I really do. I'm convinced that we'll overcome it. By the way, Mr.
The government of laws, not people.
Mr. Needham, I'm going to give you a question in writing because I was interested in your testimony on the withholding tax on foreign portfolio investment. I happen to be one that believes that we ought to encourage this foreign investment so that I may be clear as to my attitudes. But there's a question that we had about it because of testimony here before the Senate Subcommittee on International Finance and Resources. We had a congressman who was really a very competent man in the field of economics, Congressman Joseph Fisher, said that the repeal of the tax would not only discriminate against the American investor, but would also hurt the U.S. taxpayer who would foot the bill. Now, that's just his statement. I will have the staff get it to you, and you may want to.
Senator, we've already prepared a rebuttal, and we'll make it as part of the record.
I'd like that because I believe that there's considerable merit in your position, and I'd like very much to have the record.
Fortunately, Congressman Fisher,
would you see that this is prepared for Mr. Needham? Mr. Needham, thank you very much.
Chairman, could I just ask that, or I just had a couple of comments of your question. When you're talking about having workers on the board of directors, I just think back to my own business experience. I was with 25 years, and I had some of these high-priced lawyers at the Senator Stoudemire's in New York. In fact, I was in a lawsuit with the federal government with the Department of Justice, so I know what he's talking about. And I also know that when you're talking about having people on the board of directors, and you're talking about the workers, I would have no objection to having representative of our working people, of our employees. But I would have had an objection to having representative or just representing the union. And I think that's one of the great problems we have in this country, and we have to recognize it, because I feel very keenly about that. I have no objection to unions, but I certainly have objections to the union being represented on a board of directors.
Not if they put their money in it, though.
Well, if they, of course, if they are investors in it, then they have, as the, Mr. Needham has very clearly brought out, he has no objection if they follow the procedures that are set up by the Securities Exchange Commission. But I just want to make that comment because I think it's important. Now, I think Mr. Needham will agree with me on that. Now, another matter is we're talking about why people are not buying homes. In my state, they're not buying homes because the homes have been priced out of the market. And I'm very sorry about it. The cost of labor has gone up tremendously. Now, I don't say that those costs of labor have gone up. We compare what is happening in our country in the last few years or few months, many times we're talking about, and that our increase has not been commensurate with what's happened in other nations of the world. But let's look back to the time when, in New York, for instance, when they're going to the 25-hour week for the, some of the construction industry people, the wages went sky high, and then so everything's well there. But now we have quite a problem because the wages are such that we're priced on the market in many instances, and we can't go back on the